From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the news this week, two men shot dead in Texas on Sunday after they opened fire outside an event featuring Prophet Muhammad cartoons. Kim Easley witnessed the shootings.
We hear boom, 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 and a whole bunch of gunshots, and then all of a sudden we see the cops everywhere.
Also this week, the Republican field of presidential hopefuls grew bigger. Carly Fiorina and Ben Carson announced on Tuesday, Mike Huckabee on Wednesday in his hometown of Hope, Arkansas.
Now we need the kind of change that really could get America from hope to higher ground.
And Attorney General Loretta Lynch made Baltimore her first official trip on Tuesday.
I have watched the police of this city, and I know that there are difficulties. I know that we have struggles, and we are here to help you work through those struggles.
This hour on Point, our weekly roundtable goes behind the news with James Pindle of the Boston Globe, Heidi Prisbella of Bloomberg News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. What's your top story this week? What's moving the world? What's changing yours? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining me now in the studio is James Pindle. He's political reporter for the Boston Globe, focusing on the 2016 presidential race. He writes the must-read Ground Game blog. And James Pindle, good to have you in here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming in. And joining us from Washington is Heidi Prisbella. She's political and congressional reporter with Bloomberg News. And Heidi, good to have you. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And as always, from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Anthony, James, and Heidi.
All right. So let's begin with a big court ruling about the National Security Agency. A federal appeals court ruled yesterday that the once secret program of collecting Americans' phone records is illegal. The lawsuit was brought by the ACLU, and the ruling found that a provision of the USA Patriot Act does not allow for the bulk collection of calling records. The provision is set to expire next month, and the ruling comes as Congress debates whether to replace the program or leave it intact. So, Heidi, I'd like to come with you there in Washington. This ruling sounds like a big deal. Tell us what it means, what it doesn't mean. I mean, for example, does it require the NSA to cease and desist with its bulk collection program?
Right. There was no injunction included in this, and that is why it's kind of unclear at this point and creates, frankly, a real bind for Senator McConnell, just because it appears that the House is poised to go ahead and end that program in votes next week. McConnell, on the other hand, has defended it. The president has said that the phone records, the jurisdiction should be transferred to the phone companies. It shouldn't be the government keeping these records in both. And yet there are many hawks in the Senate who've defended it. And McConnell has, even in spite of all of the criticism and pressure that's been building up to this point, resisted making those changes. So he's kind of painted himself into a corner. That said, the ruling really leaves it unclear whether the current program can even continue to exist in its current format. And therefore, my guess is that next week they're going to come back and have to basically negotiate behind the scenes on some kind of compromise between what the House is doing with the USA Freedom Act and what McConnell wants to do, which is just a wholesale extension of the current program.
Mm. Well, let's get a sense of the debate in Congress. So here speaking on the Senate floor yesterday is Republican Senator Richard Burr of North Carolina, who chairs the Senate Intelligence Committee. And he said that the bulk collection program should continue. He's co-sponsoring legislation that would extend the program for another 5 years.
Why in the world would we think about rolling back the tools that are the only tools that put us post 9/11 versus pre 9/11? The threat is greater today domestically and around the world than it's ever been.
And here's Republican James Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin. He chairs the House Judiciary Committee on the September 11th attacks, and he's sponsoring a bill that would end the bulk collection program. He spoke yesterday.
I was the chairman of this committee on September 11th and the author of the Patriot Act. I can say in no uncertain terms that Congress did not intend to allow the bulk collection of Americans' records. The government's overbroad collection is based on a blatant misreading of the law.
So there it is. Jack, I'd love to bring you on this. To what extent do you see this decision as a victory for private advocates? Are we going to see a change in Congress? What do you think?
Well, it isn't a constitutional question. It's a statutory question. So it's narrower in that regard. But some of the language here, I think, is striking. The government claims, of course, that the Patriot Act, one of the provisions, gave it the power to collect relevant information to terrorism. Of course, relevant seemed to be every phone call made by someone in the United States, to which the court said that would be an unprecedented contraction of the privacy expectations of all Americans. Now, of course, that reminds us of just one of the consequences of September 11th, which is that unprecedented contraction of what we expect about privacy. And, you know, yes, this will probably help the reform effort. That is, there'll be, you know, perhaps out of this melee, this compromise that Heidi talks about, there'll be some kind of agreement will emerge that will be, from privacy points of view, perhaps better than the current system. But what it will leave out, as the Times points out, is it will not do anything. This American Freedom Act in the House and its version in the Senate, it won't do anything to deal with the overseas calls. Those can still be collected in bulk, and they can include information about Americans, as the Times points out. And most importantly, these, quote, reform measures would do nothing to establish an advocate who could represent the public before the FISA court. In other words, every time the issue comes up, can we get a warrant to spy on this or that, the public defender would be able to make the argument for the public interest, not under this reform.
Well, we're going to be talking a lot more about this issue on Monday, so let's move on to some of the other big stories of the week. And let's talk presidential politics. The race for the White House in 2016, the list of Republican hopefuls grew by 3 this week. We're going to talk about who they are. But first, James Spindle, one more sort of thought about this NSA court decision. To what extent is this going to figure in the presidential race?
I think a lot in the next month. As Heidi mentioned, we have to reauthorize the Patriot Act, or not reauthorize it. It comes up in next month. And so there is this conversation about where this is going to play out, particularly in the Senate. You know, you have a number of senators who are running for president. Folks like, you know, Rand Paul, who talk a lot about this issue, and Ted Cruz, who talks a lot about this issue. You know, Lindsey Graham talks about a strong foreign policy and doing whatever you can on terrorists. So you're going to see that, how that plays out. Where does Marco Rubio fit in? And of course, it's not just the Republican debate. There is Bernie Sanders hanging out there talking a lot about it, really forcing Hillary Clinton's hand on this issue, even though she won't be voting on it. So it could, in this early framing of this debate, be a significant data point as to where these candidates stand.
Heidi, do you agree with that?
I do. I just am struck by the odd bedfellow situation that we have here. like James mentioned, on the one hand, you've got the Bernie Sanders, very liberal kind of ACLU crowd, linking arms with guys like Tom Massey in the House, like the Tea Party hardline libertarian, and also libertarians like Rand Paul, hardliners, against, on the other hand, kind of like more the centrists of both parties. So I'm not sure what it portends in the end, other than it just gives Rand Paul a short-term platform, and depending on what Congress's final answer is to it, may, you know, continue to give him more fodder to whip up his libertarian base. We'll have to see what Congress does.
All right. Well, let's move on and talk about how this list of Republican hopefuls grew by 3 this week. Former chief executive of Hewlett-Packard, Carly Fiorina, announced that she'd be running for president. Here she is speaking on Good Morning America on Tuesday, explaining why she would make a good president.
I think I'm the best person for the job because I understand how the economy actually works. I understand the world, who's in it, how the world works. I understand bureaucracies, and that's what our federal government has become, a giant, bloated, unaccountable, corrupt bureaucracy. I understand technology, which is a tool both to reimagine government and to re-engage citizens in the process of government. And I understand executive decision making, which is making a tough call in a tough time with high stakes.
And on Monday, Ben Carson, the former Johns Hopkins pediatric neurosurgeon, formally announced his bid for the Republican nomination from a stage in Detroit. He said that individual hard work, not government assistance, makes America great. And then he called for government reform. Here he is.
We've gone far beyond what our Constitution describes, and we've begun to just allow it to expand based on what the political class wants, because they like to increase their power and their dominion over the people. And I think it's time for the people to rise up and take the government back.
So there's Ben Carson. And of course, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee also joins a crowded field, a Republican field that includes Jeb Bush, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, among others. James Spindle, I think you told me before we went on the air that you count something like 21 candidates at this point.
Yeah, it's hard to keep track. But that's right. And of course, a lot of these people who aren't officially in the race, they're running for president. Okay, yeah. It's a mechanism in terms of how much room they want to give their super PAC right now. What's the best way of collecting the most amount of money? So, but yes, there were 19 potential or current presidential candidates a couple weeks ago in New Hampshire. That did not include Ben Carson or Rick Santorum. That's how you get to 21. What struck me this week with these three who got in the race, with Huckabee and Fiorina and Carson, is that there were some unifying features here. First, all of them stress their American dream story, their humble roots. Carly Fiorina talks about how she came from being a secretary all the way to CEO of a major American company. You know, Ben Carson launched his campaign in Detroit, where he grew up in poverty. In the same way with Mike Huckabee, who also went to Hope, Arkansas. I don't know if you've ever heard of that place before. But yes, where the Clintons also identified with. And he also talked about his humble roots. And I guess the other thing to say is they are all the sort of, we talk about populism on the left, they are all trying to reach that populism on the right.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about a week in the news. You can join the conversation. After the Texas shootings, are you more worried about homegrown terrorists? There was a strong jobs report that came out just this morning, but how do things look in your neck of the woods? James Spindle, political reporter for the Boston Globe, is with us. Heidi Prisbella, political and congressional reporter from Bloomberg News. And Jack Beattie, On Point news analyst, is with us from Hanover, New Hampshire. And folks, we were talking before the break about presidential politics and the new entrants in the race. James mentioned they sort of have this up from their bootstrap story. Carly Fiorina, the former Hewlett-Packard executive. Let's talk a little bit about Ben Carson. He's pushed by the Tea Party, gained some prominence for his condemnation of Obama's Affordable Care Act, which he said is the worst thing since slavery. Jack Beattie, what do we need to understand about Ben Carson and who he is?
Well, one thing we need to understand about him is that God is talking to him. On our program in February of 2013, he came on. This was after he had had the prayer breakfast meeting with the president, and had, you know, been, because he criticized the president right to his face. He was the Wall Street Journal came out with an editorial, Ben Carson for president. And on our show, he said he didn't want anything to do with politics. He was just going to be a sort of moralist and talk big picture about what's wrong with America. And he said, the only way I'm going to get into politics, quote, that's going to take the guy who created the universe. So that guy is apparently spoken, and Ben is in the race. And, you know, he's a peculiar combination. On our show, Tom Ashbrook brought out, he's all for unity, and he's all for, you know, muting ideological differences. That sounds great. And yet his language, you mentioned some of it, you know, Obamacare, the worst thing since slavery. He's a big one for Nazi comparisons. He recently spoke of the president resembles, I think he said this, resembles a psychopath. This is language that is hard to reconcile with this emphasis on unity. It's really, you know, I mean, John Stewart is very unkind when he says that these three candidates, quote, remind him of the beginning season of Big Brother before they vote all the crazy people off the island. That's not fair. But Ben Carson, I just think that the contradictions there. I'm all for unity. I want to talk about muting differences and healing and so on. I don't see how that's reconcilable with this incendiary talk.
Well, Heidi, I know it's early times, but how do you see this very crowded field shaking out? James Spindle talked about 21 candidates. It seems like it's wide open. What happened to the idea that Jeb Bush was the 800-pound gorilla and the de facto front runner? How do you see this shaking out?
Well, first of all, I want to clarify that I think this was a great week for vice presidential candidates entering potential vice presidential candidates entering the field, possibly with the exception of Huckabee. And just quickly on Huckabee, because I covered him in 2008, I want to point out that the Republican Party, for the first time really in recent elections, is trying to harness this populist message. All of them, right up to Ted Cruz, are talking about, some of them more directly, some of them on the edges, income inequality. Jeb Bush is talking about the opportunity gap. But the real original populist in this race is Mike Huckabee. And he's not just talking about it. He's actually advocating policies that appeal to the white working class voters that have slowly migrated over to the Republican Party in the past several election cycles. He's slamming the free trade agreement that his party is championing in Congress. He's talking about protecting Social Security and not cutting Social Security and Medicare at a time when the Republican Party just dropped a very controversial budget to do just that. And so I think it's important to kind of point out how even though they're all talking about populism, Mike Huckabee is actually taking the extra step of proposing some policy behind it.
Right.
In terms of
I just wanted to also just sort of jump on that and James, just to remind folks that Mike Huckabee, on the one hand, might be regarded as a fringe candidate, but the last time he ran, he won the Iowa caucuses. He's got some real support and knows how to do this.
Absolutely, everything Heidi said was absolutely dead on. And remember, people think, again, that this populism thing is just on the left. The Tea Party movement itself was a populist movement against the elites. But obviously that happened after Mike Huckabee ran last time. He's running as this Southern Baptist, small town populist. And he's getting in trouble for that. The Club for Growth, for example, a major conservative group that's already spending money on the air to attack him. But yeah, Ted Cruz, you mentioned, I think the moment I was like, wow, this populism thing is actually happening, was last year at a, believe it or not, event sponsored by the Koch brothers. And there was Ted Cruz talking about the 1%. And of course, his spin on it was that government policies and cronyism keeps the 1% the 1%. But even the idea that we're talking about that was just fascinating to me.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Well, let's talk for a moment about the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton. She spoke in Las Vegas on Tuesday. The Democratic presidential candidate met with the Dreamers. These are immigrants who were brought to the U.S. by their parents when they were kids and were granted legal status under President Obama's executive actions. She vowed to defend their legal status. Here she is.
I will fight to stop partisan attacks on the executive actions that would put Dreamers, including those with us today, at risk of deportation. And if Congress continues to refuse to act as president, I would do everything possible under the law to go even further.
So, Heidi, this is a pretty good issue for her, it seems. And it seems to sort of put Republicans in an interesting position. They were relatively quiet in what they had to say about what she had to say about immigration this week.
That's because they are mired in an epic primary battle, and they are not in the position to make any moves on immigration in the affirmative, if you want to cast it that way. She is. She's got some challengers in the field to her left, and of course they'd all be out, running her on that issue. That's not something that's a risk for her, but it's a huge advantage if you think about who are some of the strongest candidates from the Republican Party: Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio. And where do they come from? Florida. This is an issue that's going to be a position that will position her very well for a general election once we move on to that point. And as you know, Florida is a state that Republicans cannot afford to lose. And so they've got to stay relatively quiet on it, even though Jeb Bush has been, for his party, relatively, positive on immigration and has also in the past endorsed a path to citizenship, that's the outer limits of where he can go on this issue, at least until he arrives in a general election, if he does.
Sure. James, you put your hand up.
I love the timing on this, right?
Yeah.
So she goes to Nevada. She talks about immigration. She meets with these Dreamers. And look, there's no question that this is going to be a very, very dominant issue in the general election. And then after she leaves Nevada, the Clinton campaign, their associates are spending all these off-the-record sort of conversations trying to push an immigration debate immediately on those Republican candidates visiting these early primary states. And the one person we just mentioned that is fascinating to me is Marco Rubio. He's had some really good poll numbers, particularly in New Hampshire this last week, where he jumped up to second place within the margin of error of Jeb Bush. It's the first time he has recovered since his poll numbers nosedived after he supported a comprehensive immigration bill. So now he's like, oh, we're going to do this again?
Yes, and but you know, this her taking this position, this is going to smoke these candidates out. They're now going to have to respond to it. And Fergus Cullen, who's the head of the Republican Party here in New Hampshire, put it in a piquant way. He said, "Republican intransigence on immigration has created an obvious opportunity for Hillary to, quote, rip off our arms and beat us with the bloody ends." Well, that's a pretty vivid way to put it. But now the Republican candidates who have not wanted to, you know, address this issue square on, they're going to be asked, are you in favor of extending, you know, protections to the parents of Dreamers? Are you in favor of dealing with the detention program that Hillary raised? What's your position on citizenship? She's already sort of taken shot at Jeb Bush, particularly. Bush came out for, quote, legal status in Nevada. Hillary said, when they talk about legal status, that is code for second-class status. So she's taking a shot right at him there.
Mm. Well, a lot to consider in this story, but let's move on. I want to talk about the big story out of Texas this week that raised fears of homegrown terrorism. A little background here. Police in Garland, Texas, shot and killed two suspects after they had opened fire in a parking lot outside of a controversial contest for cartoon depictions of the Prophet Muhammad. The two men were Elton Simpson and Nadir Hamid Sufi. They lived in Phoenix. They dressed in body armor, fired assault rifles. And this week, the Islamic State claimed responsibility for the attack. Now, if true, it would mark the first time that IS claimed responsibility for attack on U.S. soil. Obviously, this brings to mind the terrible massacre at Charlie Hebdo in Paris, but in this case, only the attackers were killed. But Jack, a lot to think about in this story, the debate over free speech versus respect for Muslim traditions and sensitivities around the Prophet Muhammad, concerns about the specter of homegrown terrorists, ISIS attacks on American soil. What do you take away from this story?
You know, it is disturbing, especially this dialectic of between provocation and terror. I mean, Pam Geller, one of the sponsors, if not the chief sponsor of this event, is a, you know, the Southern Poverty Law Center calls her a group, a hate group. She's led vitriolic campaigns against Muslim Americans, Muslims abroad. And this was a direct provocation. And of course, terror responds. And that really is, you know, that is a hint of more of this to come. You recoil from the thought, but it seems at least likely. And we have Mr. Comey, James Comey, the head of the FBI, talking about, you know, increasingly, are these attackers directed by foreign extremists, or inspired them, or does it make no difference either way? And he warns, and this gets back to the Patriot Act issue, he warns against the problem of what he calls going dark, namely, that the encryption, that the data is more and more being sent from some of these, quote, foreign sources, is more and more encrypted and harder for the FBI to monitor and therefore keep an eye on people like these two assailants.
Sure. Let's go to Kashif, who's calling from Boston. Kashif, you're on the air.
Hey, Anthony. So first of all, I want to acknowledge the way government handled this situation, and that was the appropriate response. Nobody should be allowed to take law in his or her hands. So that was an appropriate response. And then, as an immigrant, what I learned from this land of well-mannered people, that I cannot use N-word over here.
You cannot use the N-word, you said.
N-word.
Right, okay.
I cannot say anything about Holocaust, which is great. So why can't we come up with some rules or some guidelines that to treat every religious figure? I'm not talking about only Prophet Muhammad. I'm talking about every religious figure. Mm. Because whole world look at us. We are a first world country. And we are a very well-mannered people.
Kashif, you put a thoughtful point on the table. Heidi Prisbilla, do you want to respond to Kashif about this idea that no one is condoning the attacks in Texas, but respect for the Prophet Muhammad, an important issue here?
I don't know that you could set any kind of guidelines given the principle of religious freedom and expression that we enjoy in this country, but there certainly are other ways of expressing free speech that would be far more productive and inclusive. If the goal was to express free speech and put your thumb in the eye of ISIS, boy, did we really mess up. Because all this did was serve to strengthen ISIS, or at least the impression that ISIS has a far stronger reach into our own borders. Now, it's still very unclear that these two gentlemen had any kind of a formal connection. As a matter of fact, it looks like they probably didn't with ISIS, and yet they gave ISIS the opportunity here to make that claim and to create that impression and that fear within our country that these types of attacks will continue. And to be honest, they probably will, as long as we have people who are not more responsible about organizing, events that might be, just a better, inclusion, more inclusive of the different minority groups in our country.
Yeah. James, what do you think? I'd love you to respond to Kashif's call or give us your takeaway on this very troubling story.
Right. Well, to the call, I mean, look, we have a strong tradition of satire and freedom of expression. But I'm reminded in this whole conversation with Texas this week of a recent article in The Atlantic, I think, from Peter Beinart, talking about how particularly Muslim Americans have become the number one boogeyman or the target, particularly among conservatives. And he goes so far as to say that, yes, while we see in this Republican debate that foreign policy has emerged to become the number one issue, ahead of the economy and jobs even, running the debate for president, what we're really doing is not a foreign policy issue, it's a national security issue. And he goes so far as to argue that because we are not winning in Afghanistan and because we have these problems in the Middle East right now with us in Iraq, or what do you do with boots on the ground with ISIS, and what do we do in Syria, this is the one thing we can control. So we have this sort of almost xenophobiaism going on with Muslim Americans, and that's what's driving Fox News to constantly say, why isn't the president calling this Islamic terrorism?
Hmm. Well, it's a very troubling story. And the thing that I take away from it is, I pretty much agree with Heidi. I mean, whether or not this was directed by ISIS, it does seem inevitable that we're going to be having this conversation about these kinds of events for many years to come, which is a troubling prospect.
And Anthony, just briefly on Kashif's analogy, the N-word and Holocaust denial, you can legally say those things. It's social pressure that works against them.
Sure.
And unfortunately, that isn't working against this kind of Pam Geller, propaganda of hate.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. Glad you're joining us for the On Point podcast, sponsored by Audible.com. With Audible.com, you can listen to many of the books we feature on the show while driving, on the train, wherever you want. Talk about multitasking. They have over 180,000 book titles, plus magazines and newspapers. And now, On Point listeners can try it for free go to audible.com/onpoint and get a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial. Just go to audible.com/onpoint, download a free title, and listen. It's that easy.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, Twister Terror. More than 50 tornadoes ripped through Oklahoma's Tornado Alley on Wednesday.
In Oklahoma City, the entire airport was evacuated to an underground shelter. And warnings blared across the University of Oklahoma campus.
And what did he know and when did he know it? Deflategate is back. A report finds that Patriots quarterback Tom Brady was at least generally aware of underinflated footballs during the AFC Championship game last January. Last night, Brady responded, sort of.
It's only been 30 hours, so I haven't had much time to digest it fully, but when I do, I'll be sure to let you know how I feel about it.
And a name for Britain's newest princess. Here are Kathy Lee and Hoda getting excited about it on the Today Show.
We have a name. It's just now being announced.
Everyone together now. Charlotte Elizabeth Diana.
That's perfect. That makes me cry. Wow.
Wow. Does it make you cry? You can join the conversation. What grabbed your eye this week? The new report on Deflategate, ferry service between Florida and Cuba, the UK elections. James Pindle, political reporter for the Boston Globe, is with us. Heidi Prisbella, political and congressional reporter with Bloomberg News, is here. And Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst. And folks, before the break, we were talking about that attack in Texas and talk of homegrown terrorism. I want to take a couple of calls on this. Yuri is calling from Springfield, Illinois. Yuri, you're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. My comment is freedom of speech is not absolute. And I say that because a Caucasian person could walk up to a black bar on a Friday night and holler an epitaph, and I expect there could be violence. Vice versa, an African American could go to a country bar on a Friday night when everybody's inebriated, yell an epitaph, and could face violence. So that's freedom of speech. Yes, we have the right to say anything, but that doesn't mean that it won't have repercussions. I don't agree with the violence. But why are we inciting people to try to prove that they can be violent? We know people, you know.
Yeah. Yuri, we take your point, and I want to talk about it. I want to get another call on the table here. Let's go to Tony, who's calling from Columbus, Ohio. Tony, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, actually, very similar to what the gentleman just before said. My question was, I know that people can be charged with inciting a riot. You know, they do something and it causes a riot. And it seems to me that the lady who organized this competition should be, you know, charged with something along those lines, because it seems like that might have been the reason. But what other reason would you have for, you know, making some cartoon? And anyway, I just thought that perhaps
Tony, it's worthy of a conversation. I mean, it's an important issue that you raise. But Heidi, I guess I'd say to Tony, I'd love to get your point on this, that, you know, you walk into pretty tricky territory. I mean, if you're talking about controversial or even offensive art as being somehow beyond the pale and not allowed for fear of it causing a riot. I mean, we walk into some pretty tricky territory there.
Yeah, I don't know I'm not a legal expert, so I don't know under what law that would fall, or she could be even charged. But just like you're seeing in this case, you know, yes, like the caller said, yes, people can in this country say whatever they want, and that then they face repercussions. They can face repercussions. However, in our legal system, people who take those actions are then, you know, subject to our laws, and so it's. You're going to see that here in Texas, and I just don't know. On the other hand, what the rights of those are who are upset by it, understandably, to bring any type of charges.
I mean,
the
only thing I can think of, Jack, from a legal perspective, would be, of course, we know it's illegal to yell fire in a crowded theater if in fact there isn't a fire. But is this analogous to that?
Well, yeah, I'm just looking actually at the at the Wikipedia entry on that. That was Justice Holmes in a case to do with dissent during World War I. And it looks as if the court has since, and it was a dissent, the court didn't agree. And I think that more and more the issue now is imminent harm. There was no imminent harm to people. But if I'm fire in a crowded theater, if I'm, I don't know, if there are, say, some Muslim people in a crowd and I'm giving a speech and I say, people like these have caused terrible, and I go on and on with heaping all sorts of maledictions on them, that's incitement, direct incitement, and that is, it seems to me, prohibitable. But the incitement of a Pam Geller, that does seem well within the limits of our free speech jurisprudence.
And then when we were talking about the aftermath of this event, there was some controversy on this very topic from an NBC News analyst who said, you know what, she was not practicing free speech, she was practicing hatred. Hmm. And that's what at the heart of what that was all about, part of the national conversation this week.
Well, let's move on and talk about the brand new Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, who says she will launch a federal investigation into whether the Baltimore Police Department has engaged in a pattern or practice of excessive force. She made Baltimore her first official visit as AG, and her decision follows the death of Freddie Gray, who died of injuries while in police custody. Six Baltimore police officers, faced criminal charges in that case, which ignited riots and protests in Baltimore. And here's Loretta Lynch speaking yesterday to Congress on the Justice Department's budget. She has since announced that the Justice Department will investigate that situation in Baltimore. Let's listen to what she said.
The situation in Baltimore involves a core responsibility of the Department of Justice, not only to combat illegal conduct when it occurs, but to help prevent the circumstances that give rise to it in the first place.
So we've seen the story play out for months now, from Ferguson to New York to North Charleston, South Carolina, now Baltimore. Heidi, what does it say to you that Attorney General Lynch took this on as her first order of business, made Baltimore her first official visit?
Well, I don't think she had much of a choice. This is, on the first day that she, came in to her new job, had this riots break out and had this land directly in her lap. But at the same time, I think this is obviously part of a narrative, and one that the president in his second term has made clear that he wants to combat just this type of hopelessness that we're seeing in the streets of Baltimore. And I think at the same time, Loretta Lynch is coming in knowing that her predecessor was cast by his detractors as, in many ways, being stridently anti-law enforcement, and there were a lot of tensions in Washington between him and Republicans. She doesn't want that, and she does not want to be seen as beating up on already embattled police officers, a number of whom, by the way, were injured in the course of doing their jobs in those conflicts. So I think that she has a delicate line to walk here. However, after going into Baltimore and meeting with all of the relevant officials, she kind of tipped her hand yesterday in testimony up on the Hill and said that Baltimore is making great strides in trying to address some of the underlying problems. However, there's certainly reasonable question about whether more needs to be done. And I think that might be pointing us in the direction of a potential investigation. But the one thing I wanted to point out is that this situation is, while part of a narrative, is in some ways, important ways, different from Ferguson. Baltimore like Ferguson, there's been a history of excessive use of force by the police. But if you look at the power brokers in Baltimore, the city council, the mayor, they're all minorities. The police force, even though whites are overrepresented relative to the general population, it is still majority minority. And so I think the fact that you have African Americans taking the helm in these leadership roles diffuses it a little bit from what happened in Ferguson. You know, not a ton to the extent that there won't be an investigation, but I think it's important to point out.
Hmm. Jack, I'd love to bring you in on this. Heidi talked about some important differences there with Ferguson, but as we've mentioned, we've seen these troubling stories of police misconduct, police-involved shootings from all over the country. Is federal scrutiny, federal involvement, what's needed here? Is it going to help?
Well, it's got, let's put it this way, there's something for it to feed on. I'm holding a big takeout from the Baltimore Sun from last fall called Undue Force, and it shows the photographs of six people, men and women, battered, and they were battered by police, and the piece goes on to say that about $6 million since 2011 has been paid out in lawsuits because of this kind of beating up, and that record is one of the reasons there's such a gap, such an alienation between the people and the police. And are these civil rights violations? We don't know. Will this result in the kind of report on the Baltimore Police Department that the Justice Department issued on the Ferguson Police Department? We don't know. It's certainly going to result in more investigation, and it looks like there's a reason. You know, there's lots of things to investigate here.
Let's move on. There was some pretty good economic news this morning. A jobs report out today. According to the Labor Department, the economy added 223,000 jobs last month, pushing the unemployment rate down to 5.4%. That's a 7-year low. Now, there'd been concerns that the economy was losing steam. James, this latest report seems to suggest otherwise, that things are that dip in the winter was sort of a winter aberration. What do you see in this jobs report?
Yeah, growth in construction jobs as well. This is maybe a hopeful sign. This has been such a stubborn economy for so long, and is obviously something that people are talking a lot about. But clearly, there are some fundamentals here which still have not really improved. And you're starting to hear them being talked about more in the national conversation. If you are a millennial, it's really hard. We're seeing people delay even more. I think a new study came out this week. Mm-hmm. People delaying marriage again. People delaying having children. Part of that is a whole generational shift anyway in terms of people waiting and getting more established in their careers. Part of it is they can't afford to buy a home. They can't get credit to buy a home. They still have huge student loans. They're not in a position to do that. So there's still some fundamentals that are not going very well for people, but clearly these is hopeful numbers today.
Sure. Of course, this says nothing, I mean, as you suggest, about the high cost of education, the high cost of housing, the high cost of health insurance, and the struggles faced by working families out there. Still some pretty good news on the jobs front there. I want to leave time before we wrap up today to talk about this story, which is Boston-based. Tom Brady says he didn't know. The NFL says he probably did. And of course, we're talking about Deflategate. And that's the allegation that the New England Patriots personnel deliberately deflated footballs used by the Pats in the AFC Championship game last January. It's an allegation that Brady denied just 4 days after that game. Here he is.
I have no knowledge of anything. I have no knowledge of any wrongdoing of any.
Nobody did anything wrong.
Yeah, I'm very comfortable saying that. I'm very comfortable saying that nobody did it, as far as I know.
And of course, yesterday, Brady issued a statement through his agent. He calls the report a terrible disappointment written by lawyers who don't understand the context or culture of the sport. Last night, he didn't say much of anything about it when given an opportunity, said he hadn't had time to digest the report. But James, I'll come to you first, since you've been, in the Boston ethos imbibing this story. I mean, is the takeaway here that the Patriots are Super Bowl champions and cheaters?
That's the question right now. Look, I got to say this, since we're in Boston right now and don't get kicked out. Everyone agrees in the fact that the Patriots won the Super Bowl, that they had a great season, that they would have won no matter what happened. Remember, that was such a lopsided game against the Indianapolis Colts that we're talking about these deflated footballs. And this report that came out, you cannot take that to a court of law. People are talking about, does Brady get fined? Does he had to sit out a couple of games? That's going to be really hard, I think, for them, even the NFL, to really pull off, given the fact that this is so circumstantial in the evidence. But The court here that matters is the court of public opinion. The Patriots are already not very well liked. And this is the problem that Brady has. He's clearly going to go to the Hall of Fame. But are people, if not technically, going to put an asterisk next to his name in the Hall of Fame? When they walk in, they see his name. Are they going to think in the back of their mind, yeah, but there was Deflategate and there was Spygate and there's everything else?
Let's take a call on this. Gabe is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Gabe, you're on the air.
Hey, Anthony. Yeah, I'm calling about this this story, what I call Hategate. It's obviously not the most important of the week, but I think it can shed light on, our media and, culture has just got out of whack. I mean, what happened to facts? What happened to facts? This reminds me when Sarah Palin yelled death panels around the Affordable Care Act, and everyone went nuts because it's what they wanted to hear, but it wasn't true, but people still think it's true. I mean, this is nuts. This is the NFL trying to explain why they let this controversy go, because it's a controversy they liked. It's not about beating women. It's not about beating kids. But there's no facts here. And I understand people hate Patriots. And honestly, I will criticize Tom Brady and the Patriots, before anybody else. I knew Olden Lloyd. He was a great guy, very classy.
But, Gabe, very quickly, let me just jump in. You say there are no facts. I mean, there are videos showing an equipment manager disappearing into a bathroom with a bag full of balls and coming out. The fact is there were 13 balls that were underinflated. I mean, there are some facts. I mean, maybe the conclusion is incorrect.
No, it's circumstantial, and the whole issue about air in footballs is really something that was kind of, created for this event. Boomer Sizemore was like, this is total baloney. Those aren't the words he used. But, from a QB's point of view, this is just, they made an issue because they wanted to take down the pass.
Well, I certainly agree with you that the NFL has much bigger and more troubling issues to deal with than underinflated footballs. But never nice to learn about the possibility of a hometown team cheating. Heidi Prisbell, a political and congressional reporter for Bloomberg News, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And James Pindle, political reporter for the Boston Globe, thank you.
Thanks.
And Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst, always a pleasure.
Thank you.
And listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. Have a great weekend. This is On Point.